Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on rioting in Afghanistan following the burning of Korans at a US base and look into the selective nature of the outrage since the same rioters routinely sack Shiite mosques and burn Korans along with people. Chris Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan, joins us to analyze why the people whose nation we are trying to build appear to hate us and want us out of their country. Then Senator Russ Feingold joins us. He is the author of the new book, While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post-9/11 era. The only senator to vote against the Patriot Act, we will discuss how much we have waged the war on terror on ourselves and our own values, and how we are alienating the Islamic world by demonizing Muslims who want the freedoms we have and want to be free of the dictatorships that we have supported. Then finally, with tonight's Academy Awards broadcast expected to reach a record global audience, cultural critic and media expert and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside, Toby Miller, joins us. We will discuss the global influence of Hollywood movies in an era when piracy is diminishing box office returns and big-budget, special effects-laden comic book blockbusters have driven highbrow, lower-budget movies towards extinction. Let's begin with Christine Fair, who is a former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And clearly, the situation in Afghanistan has reached, I should think, for our men and women in uniform, a pretty untenable situation. If you have a U.S. colonel and a U.S. major being murdered inside the secure Ministry of Interior, and I imagine a general sense amongst the soldiers over there serving that the people that they're trying to rescue and make a viable economy and a life for, and for whom a lot of American lives have been sacrificed, seem to be fairly ungrateful at the very least, and they seem to be demonstrating in large numbers, asking the U.S. to leave. So, how do you think the service people feel about serving a country where it appears a lot of the people want them to get out?
Well, it's been my experience over the several years I've been going to Afghanistan that is pretty much the sentiment. I remember last summer when I was at the COIN Academy, the Counterinsurgency Academy run by the Americans there at Kabul, I was in the shower room and I was overhearing a female sergeant in very colorful terms explaining her exasperation with the new bunch of folks that she was tasked with training. And I couldn't help but overhear the conversation. She says, forget, and I'm going to leave the expletives out because I don't think you're supposed to have expletives on this show. But she said, forget the dancing monkey and the PowerPoint slide. I can reduce this for you in a matter of sentences. These people hate you. They want to kill you. But that really won't affect you because you will never leave this base. And there's a certain amount of brilliance in that relatively parsimonious statement because it's absolutely true. The few Americans that do get out find themselves in extreme harm's way. Folks, far from being grateful, are actually exceedingly resentful. They tend to blame the counterinsurgency on the Americans, which has become sort of a stand-in for all of the Westerners operating there under the NATO umbrella. And what they have seen has largely been a degradation in the kinds of personal security rather than an improvement in the same. And therefore, even though they don't like the Taliban, I've had a number of people tell me that at least when the Taliban were in power, they didn't have to worry about their houses being robbed or their women being raped. So, my own personal view, and it's been this way for a very long time, as you know, is that the mission that we have slowly accepted was never tenable to begin with, given our interest, well, given the cost either in terms of finances or in terms of blood that we're willing to pay. And it really is time to get out.
So In terms of nation building, my understanding is there are two major components, and that is the USAID component, and of course the notion that we are building a viable Afghan army and a viable Afghan police force in order to have some stability when we leave. Beginning with the first, Chris Fair, the aid. There's just been some recent reports that are quite alarming, the extent to which so much of the aid is either being lost in what's euphemistically called bureaucratic mismanagement, or in fact being stolen outright. And their estimates up to 40% of it being stolen outright. And apparently the Afghan Central Bank has tried to do something about capital flight. Here's a country where we're pouring money in, but every day millions and millions of US dollars in cash exit Kabul's airport, and an estimated $4.6 billion in cash, more than the country's government budget, left Afghanistan in 2011, according to the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, you already summed it up. Whenever I fly from Kabul to Dubai, I always want to climb into the baggage hold to reclaim some of my tax dollars, because literally, there are literal pallets of $100 bills being shipped in the cargo holds of those planes. And here's the outrageous part. It's being done so openly that usually those monies are declared, which is how we know about these preposterous sums. At one point, the Department of Treasury wanted to monitor the amounts of funds leaving. That's really not, I mean, quantifying it is kind of interesting, but the real problem is why is it actually leaving? But look, the problems with USAID, and I want to be very clear, it's not just USAID. All of the national aid programs suffer from very similar problems. I mean, there are some exceptions, like the Canadian aid problem. The Canadian aid program doesn't seem to be as problematic as the UK DFID or the US USAID program. But even the Germans, GTZ, everyone is kind of laboring under similar problems. The first kind of goes like this. The days of the American USAID poorly paid employee/volunteer going out and building an irrigation system, those days are gone. Those days in the 50s, you talk to Afghans, oh yeah, you know, who happened to live that long. I remember Americans out there digging a ditch. Those days are gone. What USAID has really become is like a booking agency. So they'll outsource large projects to sort of industrial contractors who then hire subcontractors who then subsequently hire subcontractors. So at every single layer of contracting, I know because I've been a USAID contractor and other kinds of contractors, the organization doing the paperwork basically gets an overhead cut just to basically have the privilege of having some part of this grant. So when Richard Holbrooke was alive and when he first took over the portfolio, he estimated that, speaking of USAID alone, every 90 cents for every dollar allocated, about approximately 90 cents actually came back to the U.S. in this institutional overhead. The other problem is, for you to get anything done in Afghanistan, you really have to pay the right person. And if you don't pay the right person, you're going to find IEDs on your road. You're going to find your employees being targeted. And so you really have to spread the money around to make sure that, I love it when they are our guy, we call them strong men, but you know, when they're a nuisance, we call them warlords. You have to make sure that the money goes all the way around. And then in addition, just getting the logistics anywhere in Afghanistan frankly requires paying the different militant groups associated with the Taliban a handsome fee. So we could spend your entire show talking about the delinquent malfeasance and just absolute lack of progress coming out of U.S. programming, because, you know, at some point you have to also remember, from USAID's point of view, what they're being judged upon is execution of the funds. They're not being judged upon what are the outcomes. They're actually just being judged on are the funds executed? Is there going to be an output? If we want to build a bridge, is there a bridge? Whether or not that bridge actually endures the first flood or the first rain is immaterial. It's all about execution. Going to the second part of your question, which is about training the ANSF, I mean, that's almost a serious joke is the first part. at steady state, it's really hard to imagine an Afghan National Army more than 100,000 for any number of reasons. A, people don't want to serve. They like being near their homes. Being a part of a national organization requires them to not be near their homes. Training the Afghan National Police is even a bigger problem. The vast majority of the police, like the ANA, they're not even literate. I could, again, could go on at length about this. But what the U.S. has essentially done with our NATO allies, and quite frankly with the connivance of the Afghan Ministry of Defense for obvious reasons, we have built an enormous Afghan National Security Force infrastructure comprised of the Army, comprised of the different police forces, as well as the other services. The Afghan government, of course, has absolutely no ability to pay for any aspect of its functioning, not even the recurring cost of salaries. So the real question is, given that the Afghan state can't pay for any of this, and given that we've built a supersized government, and given that as troops draw down, parliaments, including our Congress, are going to be less enthusiastic about paying the bills, what happens to this now 340-some-odd thousand Afghan National Security Force that we've paid for? It's going to become bedlam, mayhem, all hell is going to break loose. And most people that you talk to who travel frequently to Afghanistan will tell you people are bracing for civil war. And I have to say, I suspect that's, in my view, that's where this is heading.
But in terms of training Afghan soldiers, you've just pointed out how tenuous the whole thing is, because as soon as we pull the financial plug, this kind of Potemkin village is going to collapse. But meanwhile, while we are training the soldiers and police, a lot of them are killing NATO and American soldiers, not the least of which, of course, is what just happened inside the Ministry of Interior building, but also today in Kunduz province, a U.S. Special Forces base, somebody tossed a grenade, wounding seven U.S. Special Forces. So this has been going on for some time. I mean, are there any statistics on it?
I don't think so. But what there have been efforts for some time to try to get Afghan intelligence, the NDF, to try to implement better screening. They're even talking about biometric measures to keep a better eye on who's joining the ANSF, because one of the things that we've seen in recent years is that either insurgents disguised as Afghan National Security Force personnel or people who are in uniform, Afghans in uniform, who just decide they're going to take up the gun against the Americans and NATO, they've been killing these folks while in uniform. I actually just stopped counting the incidents because there had been so many. But this really began with a fairly alarming frequency, maybe 3 to 4 years ago. But it's given that that there is such an urgent demand, a perceived urgent demand, to create ANSF, you know, to Afghan National Security Forces, and given that it's kind of hard to recruit these folks, I mean, basically they'll take anyone. So if you were the Taliban or militants associated or sympathetic to the Taliban, this is a no-brainer. Put your murderous goon in the process for applying to join the Afghan National Police or the Afghan National Army. It's the easiest thing in the world. So there's a lot of concern, and obviously if you're the Afghan Taliban and their allied associates, you see the end is near. The Americans want out. So our staying power is declining as their interest in driving us out is intensifying. So I actually expect we're going to see more of this faux fratricide. I mean, I'm saying faux fratricide because allegedly we're supposed to be in the same team. And there have equally been incidents of insurgents in uniform or people in uniform who became insurgents also killing Afghan forces that are working with the Americans. So this is a big problem, and it's not obvious what you do about it other than endure it, because if you're trying to build an ANSF force that is this big, you're not going to be able to do this big and this quickly. You're not going to be able to do the due diligence that you need to keep the wackos out.
Well, it looks like, Chris Fair, that this police officer who was working for the Intelligence Department of the Ministry of Interior, he's apparently disappeared. It looks as though he may well have been one of the people you're talking about, a Taliban mole.
That's just entirely possible. I mean, there are so many people that are expected of being Taliban mole and are Taliban moles, and it's really difficult to do the kinds of checks. Look, I mean, think about this. 11 years into this war, we don't even have a proper amount of capable linguists. So we are still dependent upon interpreters. And the interpreters that are working with the Americans and NATO, we sort of assume that they're on our team. Well, why in the world would you assume that? I've had so many conversations with these firms to which the U.S. Armed Forces outsource finding interpreters. So, you know, I myself have language training, and on LinkedIn or other venues, I'm constantly being approached. Do you have any language? Do you know anyone that's like, you know, competent in XYZ languages? And they need linguists faster than they can actually vet them. And their efforts to get American linguists, for a number of reasons, have failed, even though we're training thousands of linguists. And we're training lots of people through the Title VI, which is the FLAS program, as well as through the Critical Language program. The issue is, and I know this from my own experience, when you have a linguist who spent a lot of time outside of the country, someone like I have, it's very difficult to clear them. When I go through U.S. government processing, they consider me to be a counterterrorism or a counterintelligence threat, even though my language studies were all paid for by the government. So there's this horrific irony that we're training all these people, but by training linguists who then go and try to dedicate their studies to learning these languages outside of the U.S., we've essentially made them unclearable. And so we're having to constantly go back to the well in Afghanistan for these linguists. And it's these linguists who, in turn, are helping to vet these folks who are killing our troops. This is, I don't know what else to call this other than retardation.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan. She's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're talking about the latest deaths of an American colonel and a major inside of the Interior Ministry, apparently killed by an Afghan policeman in the Intelligence Department of the Ministry of Interior, who has since disappeared. There's been a rash of killings of U.S. soldiers training Afghan police and military, and all of this in the context of riots going on still following the burning of some Qurans at the major U.S. base there. And these Qurans that were burned apparently were ones that they took off militants who had, I don't know whether they were already a militant version of the Quran or whether they had been had some scribblings in them. But it's pretty hard to believe that somebody in the U.S. military was brain dead enough to burn them and allow that to become such an incident. But to my mind, it raises some fundamental questions about the very people who are demonstrating in the streets. It's fairly routine, from what I can tell, in Pakistan at least, for these Sunni fundamentalists to burn and sack Shiite mosques and murder people and burn them alive in their churches or mosques, not to mention burning the Qurans.
You know, it's almost to the point where it's very difficult for me to have a conversation that remains in a scholarly realm about this, because the murderous hypocrisy is so difficult to tolerate. When the Taliban go in and raise girls' schools in Pakistan, or in Afghanistan for that matter, they destroy dozens of Qurans. When they blow up Shia mosques, hundreds of Qurans. So this is not about Quran burning. Let's just say that for the moment of argumentation, that it is about Quran burning. Howsoever heinous that is, it doesn't justify killing innocent people who had nothing to do. And what I find really, one of the things that I find very frustrating is someone who spends a lot of time in the Muslim world, spends a lot of time in South Asia. I am really exhausted to the point where I don't even know how to, I can't even keep myself within a scholarly circle when I try to express my exhaustion with people justifying murder because the Quran was burnt. And there is, you know, I know in my own tweets I've been attacked by nutters of a variety, you know, all sorts of religious bents. Facebook the same. What I find really interesting, and this raises issues of globalization, citizenship, human rights, global values, I think it's really interesting that that folks, for example, in Pakistan or Afghanistan, where I spend more of my time than other places, they will decry the abuses that Muslim minorities experience in Western countries. Now, I'm going to be also very clear, in the few places where I'm actually going to defend the U.S. system, minorities in the United States have a lot more freedom to practice, to gather, to assemble, to observe their faith than minorities do in Pakistan or minorities do in Afghanistan. It is actually considered a criminal offense punishable by death if you convert to another faith from Islam in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so one of the things I find myself consistently shocked by is that folks will demand treatment in other parts of the world that they will not even tolerate to be extended to the minorities in their own country. And one of the things that I've become very frustrated with is someone who moves, you know, back and forth, and I have many Pakistani friends and many Muslim friends, I'm increasingly at a loss as to how to negotiate the fact that one of the reasons why in the United States religious minorities of all varieties tend to have so much more civil liberties than they do in, say, Muslim countries, I would imagine, although I don't spend time in preponderantly Catholic countries, or I don't even know if there are countries where Catholicism is law. That's how ignorant I am, because I'm only a South Asianist. But the reason why there is such relative freedom here is that there is freedom of speech. So the same side, the other side of the very coin that confers freedom of speech also gives religious freedom and other kinds of freedom to engage in speech acts that are deemed offensive by others, such as, for example, these idiots that go around burning Qurans. And so it's very difficult to have a discussion about what are the limits of civil liberties. And this is just one of those issues that cuts to the core. And if I were finding people in Pakistan, for example, arguing that Bibles shouldn't be burnt, that Shia mosques couldn't be burnt, with the same vociferousness as we see organized protests against, this was apparently, in fact, an unintentional Quran burning. It's how do you go forward if this is the way in which the terrain of the debate is laid out?
Well, the terrain of the debate now, Chris Fair, is even more confused because we have a presidential campaign already. You have Newt Gingrich complaining that President Obama apologized about the burning of the Quran. And frankly, there is some confusion in this country about our approach to religious fanaticism, whether it's Islamic or Christian. We have, in many ways, Rick Santorum, what he's suggesting when he just yesterday said Obama was a snob because he thought Americans should go to college.
When he has more degrees than Obama.
Right, but he also is an advocate of homeschooling. He doesn't believe in public school. He, in effect, believes in American madrasas.
Well, okay, so it's interesting that you raise this point of American madrasas, because I think madrasas or madrasas get a pretty bad rap. They tend to be too easily conflated with things that are bad when there's actually quite a number of madrasas or madrasas. But I think what the two issues have in common, parents who send their kids to madrasas for full-time schooling, for the most part, kids go to madrasas in conjunction with other kinds of schools. So in that sense, it's more akin to going to catechism classes after school, or there's a similar version that my Catholic friends went to every Friday night, or for that matter, going to Torah school, you might study for bat mitzvah or bar mitzvah. And so most students that go to a madrasa will do so for a very brief amount of time, generally learning to recite the Quran, or maybe even if they're capable and adequately ambitious, to memorize the Quran. So it's a very small number of people who actually go to a madrasa full time. And remember, the parents are typically making that decision. And so in that sense, when I look at families that decide to homeschool and families that decide to send their kids to madrasas, one has to really ask for the values of the family, that their family somehow thinks that interacting with fellow citizens and understanding the diversity of their country, a diversity in beliefs, a diversity in morals and ethics and what's good, right, and appropriate, families actually want to take their children out of that environment so that they can vertically integrate their own moral sphere with those of their children. And I can tell you, I have family members that are homeschoolers in Indiana. Dare I say it, they're not terribly well educated themselves. And so I kind of, you know, this whole idea of like, who gets to homeschool and what's the criteria of achievement is kind of mind-boggling. But I think the point that you're raising is something that I've observed over the last 10 years. Pakistanis and Americans have responded to the events of 9/11 in really frighteningly similar ways. For many Americans and for many Pakistanis, nationalism and the majority faith have become totally imbricated. So being a certain kind of Muslim has become associated with being nationalism. Pakistan's a Muslim country, and not just any kind of Muslim, but a specific kind of Muslim. And this is why we see all the sectarian violence that we see, and it's been increasing. In the United States, the response has been, we're a Christian country. And very similar, what I'm going to just call very, using terribly normal, moralistic or normative expressions, an absolute ignorant expression of faith. In Pakistan, many of the things that they believe about Islam have no grounding in their faith whatsoever. And I'll say very similar normative statements about the religious fundamentalism that is embracing the United States. Absolute ignorance. And how do you have a dialogue between two countries where basically religious extremists, and by extremists I don't necessarily mean violent, but people who choose to believe or embrace interpretations of their faith, which were a number of years ago in the extreme, but which are now mainstream. How do you have a discussion when these two important countries have really located themselves on similar trajectories? And same people in Pakistan who want a different Pakistan, they're like me and you here, you know, except the price is higher. I mean, if you object to the blasphemy law in Pakistan because it's, even if you reject it because it's not consistent with the evidentiary standards of the Quran, you may very well be killed. So the space in both of our countries for contesting the kind of country that we want, in my experience, has been shrinking. And it's a very frightening space to be in when you don't feel like you have the space to fight for what you think your founding fathers intended. And, of course, in both cases, they were founding fathers. There were no founding mothers.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Kabul, Afghanistan. She's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Senator Russ Feingold. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Russ Feingold, who represented the state of Wisconsin in the United States Senate from 1993 to 2011, serving on the Judiciary, Foreign Relations, Budget, and Intelligence Committees, a former Rhodes Scholar and an honors law graduate from both Harvard Law School and Oxford University. Since leaving the Senate, Senator Feingold founded Progressive United, an organization devoted to challenging the dominance of corporate money over our democracy. He's the author of the new book just out, While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post-9/11 era. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Russ Feingold.
So much for having me on the show.
And obviously, While America Sleeps is borrowed from Winston Churchill's 1938 book, While England Slept. And then later, of course, John Fitzgerald Kennedy wrote Why England Slept. And Churchill, of course, wrote in his book, New Conditions, the new conditions under which we now have to dwell. What are the new conditions under which we have to dwell today?
Well, your account of where I got the title from is exactly right. And that's part of a quote from Churchill where he's warning the English people of the buildup of German armaments. And he says, you know, we're England's like sort of like an island, is an island nation, and we sort of got the attitude that we were invincible. Well, I think we got a wake-up call on 9/11 10 years ago. And I think we all realized that we had to have a better awareness of the rest of the world and get ahead of crises and threats. But it seems to me like we've gone back to sleep. It seems to me that we're not doing that now. We're so at each other's throats domestically and acting as if Al-Qaeda is all done, which it is not. And so it reminds me a little bit of our lack of listening to warnings in the past. And I'm trying to say to people, we have got to be able to do both domestic and international things at the same time in order to be safe.
But it seems in many ways you voted against the Patriot Act, a lone voice in that regard, that in many ways we seem to be punishing ourselves for what others have done to us with the National Defense Authorization Act. And I've never understood why this global war on terror, why it is that we are attacking Islam rather than Islamic radicals. And the only people who can dissuade an Islamist from becoming a radical are moderate Islamists. And surely they're the people that we should be nurturing.
You know, you couldn't be more right. The first half of my book, While America Sleeps, is about the international mistakes we've made, sort of invading one country at a time and not really looking at Al-Qaeda as a whole. We see the tragic consequences of that in Afghanistan today, where we stayed far too long. But there's also the domestic side. It's what I call it, what you're talking about, the exploitation of the fear of 9/11, using it to pass a Patriot Act that still hasn't been fixed, that allows the government to go after people's library records who've done nothing wrong. And as you very well mentioned, you know, the way in which Muslims in America are being treated in the last couple of years, after a pretty good start, they're being made to feel pretty unwelcome in this country with ridiculous things like not letting people open up a mosque in southern Manhattan. That is a huge mistake because it sends a signal both domestically to some 10 million people, but it also sends a very negative message to a billion people around the world, most of whom are peaceful and most of whom we would like to have a good relationship with. So, yeah, there's both the international and domestic side of the failure and what I call the going to sleep syndrome.
And Senator Russ Feingold, in your book, While America Sleeps, A Wake-Up Call for the Post-9/11 Era, you talk about how you were wasting so much of your time there in the United States Senate impeaching President Clinton while Al-Qaeda, who are essentially serial killers, were kept striking at us. And as you recall, after the U.S. embassies in Africa were bombed, President Clinton sent some cruise missiles, which would have perhaps got bin Laden had the Pakistanis not tipped him off. But the long and the short of it is, at that time, I recall that the Republicans were saying that he was trying to distract America from his problems involving consensual dalliance with
the famous wag the dog accusation. Remember that?
I do. That's
what. Yeah, and that's exactly right. So they were so busy with their cultural war, as Henry Hyde called it, that, you know, the really obvious signals weren't picked up by any of us in a way that it should have been. It was, yeah, the bombing of the embassies in Africa. Also, just a year after the impeachment trial, the attack on the USS Cole in Aden Harbor, where 17 American sailors died. The early 2001, remember those ancient Buddha statues that were destroyed by these crazy Taliban people? There were so many warnings that we didn't pick up because we were distracted. Well, I would argue the same thing is happening right now. Take a look at what's happened in Nigeria in the last year with a group called Boko Haram. They're acting very much like an Al-Qaeda kind of group. They pulled off all kinds of attacks, including yesterday. They killed 180 people on January 20th in six separate attacks in Kano. They blew up a UN facility, and it's like we saw this movie before. Why aren't we paying attention to a continually active threat? People already have this attitude that it's all over, and it's not.
Well, isn't it more than a threat, though, in the sense that we are so compromised with our relationship with Saudi Arabia? After all, that is where Al Qaeda came from, and they're still the mosques. The Saudis are funding mosques and madrasas all around the place, including in Nigeria.
A lot of it does come from there. Mm-hmm.
And here we are, totally dependent upon their oil, and a lot of people are now saying we've got to go to war with Iran because they might shut off the Saudi oil. Maybe we shouldn't be quite a big footprint in that part of the world and be so dependent on the drug that we're hooked on, which is their oil.
Well, that's a huge part of the problem. And, you know, a lot of the problem with our relationship with the countries that are having the Arab Spring has to do with the fact that we support these dictators or regimes that deny the people of those countries the things that we say we value. Democracy, human rights, women's rights, all the way from Tunisia to Egypt to Yemen to Pakistan under Musharraf, and certainly including Saudi Arabia. This is a huge part of the resentment that fuels some of these groups, whether they're directly linked to Al-Qaeda or not, and we have got to realize there's a consequence for doing this sort of thing.
So in terms of, obviously, we were very disappointed, those of us and most of our audience is pretty progressive, Senator Feingold, that you lost your Senate seat. And I noticed recently Barney Frank, who's retiring, was when people complain on the progressive side about President Obama not having delivered on all of the hopes and dreams, Barney Frank said, well, you know, one of the problems is the American people. After all, they voted for Obama in 2008, and 2 years later, they voted for the Tea Party. And I'm wondering what it is about that, and you in many ways are a victim of the fact that people just didn't show up in 2010. Are they going to show up in 2012?
Well, that often happens in the off-year elections, and of course, particularly with the economy bad, our side was depressed. You know, people forget that, you know, Obama wasn't even president when the collapse occurred. But the Tea Party did a brilliant job, and then they got co-opted by the Republican Party into turning this into an excuse for big government and big wealthy interests in Washington instead of the opposite. But you know what? I'm not giving up the fight. I'm fighting it on this international issue. I'm fighting on domestic issues, as you said, fighting the power of big money through my group, Progressives United, at progressivesunited.org. And I'm getting excited. I think Obama's going to win, and I think he's going to have a great second term. And I think these right-wingers are going to be discredited because they've thrown everything but the kitchen sink at President Obama. And if he survives, he's going to be in good shape to deliver on some of these things we hope he does.
Well, there has been a significant change in terms of the political zeitgeist, and that's been the Occupy movement in terms of framing things in terms of the 99% versus the 1%. But do you think that we should really call it as it is and question the extent to which our democracy has become a kind of corporate plutonomy or an oligarchy?
Well, it really does so look like that after the Citizens United decision. I'll be giving a speech at Stanford University tomorrow night on this very subject. The corporate domination of our political system to the greatest extent in 100 years as a result of that terrible decision of the United States Supreme Court 2 years ago. That decision has to be overturned. And I think so much is happening with regard to the corruption and disturbing, undisclosed, unlimited contributions. I believe that can happen. But it can only happen if President Obama is reelected so he can appoint the upcoming Supreme Court vacancies.
So what do you tell people that are disillusioned and on the progressive side? I mean, we're always told we got to vote at the last ditch because of the Supreme Court. But in many ways, there seems to be more at stake than ever now.
I would agree with that. It didn't seem like that was possible a couple of years ago, but this decision threw our governmental system into chaos. And even some of the justices are acknowledging that this decision was one of the worst in the history of the country, and something has to be done to address it soon.
Well, Senator, I know you've got to go, but I hope we can get a moment soon to have a more in-depth interview with you.
Well, I don't see why not. I would really enjoy that.
Well, we'll try and arrange it.
I'll be in Los Angeles making appearances this coming weekend concerning the book While America Sleeps, and I look forward to seeing people.
Well, thanks a lot. We hope we can do
next
it.
Weekend.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Russ Feingold, who represents the state of Wisconsin in the United States Senate from 1993 to 2011, serving on the Judiciary, Foreign Relations, Budget, and Intelligence Committees. He's a former Rhodes Scholar and an honors law graduate from both Harvard Law School and Oxford University. Since leaving the Senate, Senator Feingold founded Progressives United, an organization devoted to challenging the dominance of corporate money over our democracy. He's the author of the new book just out, While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post 9/11 era. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Academy Awards coming up tonight.
And tomorrow, America just might fall apart. Tomorrow, tell me where will you wake up? Beyond title, beyond lease, careers and law.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Miller, the chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. He is one of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Technologies of Truth, Cultural Citizenship, and the Popular Media. Global Hollywood, Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back. Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, and Television Studies, The Basics. His forthcoming book is Greening the Media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
It's a pleasure.
And tonight's Academy Awards are expected to, the broadcast is expected to reach a record global audience. It has been, in terms of one who covers national security affairs, it's an interesting omission in the way that we look at national security, not in the broader issues in terms of, we only look at it in narrow military terms, but in terms of America's soft power and its influence around the world, probably nothing has been more successful than Hollywood. Would you argue that?
I think you could argue that. This term soft power, but it's associated with Joseph Nye, who is an academic and used to be a policy guy in the Clinton administration, encompasses the idea of public diplomacy and the whole notion that you can get beyond the difficulties of state-to-state relationships and corporate-to-state relationships between different nations if you have what's thought of as a more organic connection between populations. And however weirdly that might seem, Hollywood is regarded as capable of cutting through the dross that often makes things difficult in our foreign policy between the United States and other countries.
So why is it then that the Republicans and the conservatives in this country hate Hollywood if it's in fact a great adjunct to American power?
Well, the Republicans have a number of different agendas, obviously, as do the Democrats. One agenda of the Republicans is to undercut financial sources of the Democratic Party. That's why it's in favor of so-called tort reform, i.e. getting rid of class action lawsuits, because they're A, an effective means of the working class getting political redress, and B, they're an effective means of providing the part of the ruling class with its money that supports the Democratic Party. That's also the reason why they don't like Hollywood, because Hollywood is basically populated by people of a fairly liberal persuasion in American political terms, as are most of the arts, and they provide large amounts of money to Democratic administrations and aspirants. In addition to that, there is a political component that's ideological that one would have to consider as well.
And that is?
Well, if you look back to the period of the so-called culture wars of the late 80s, early 90s, and the assaults on the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities by successive Republican administrations and politicians, the notion was that the image internally and externally of the country was going to the dogs. In other words, it was being taken over by minorities, by gays, by people who were using entertainment and the arts for their own political agendas. So when the Republican administration got into power in 2001 under George W. Bush, by the way, I had a nightmare last night where he was a friend of mine. The minute they got into power, the first thing they did was basically cut the State Department's entire public diplomacy budget. Mind you, that wasn't only more than a few months, as we know, before September the 11th, after which they ploughed hundreds of millions into the State Department's cultural budget. So they think that there's something bad about the image Hollywood gives to the world, but they also want to use it as a tool, at the same time as they want to undermine its legitimacy and its money by associating it with liberalism.
So, Toby Miller, given the hegemonic power of Hollywood in terms of its being one of the more effective tools of American influence. Clearly, the military tool has backfired with the Iraq war, and it's backfiring in Afghanistan. But I'm wondering, in the current globalization, how is Hollywood going to hold on to its hegemony and its box office receipts given the advent of piracy?
Piracy could be regarded as a major problem for Hollywood. Alternatively, one could regard it as very free public relations, free merchandising, free marketing. If you think about the number of people entering the global middle class around the world in rapidly developing economies, getting across your market message to them that you have an interesting product would be extremely expensive. If, on the other hand, piracy, the illegal, in inverted commas, use of your movies, for example, or TV shows as calling cards, introduces the Hollywood concept, the high concept of expensive movie making, and influences the tastes of this emergent middle class, suddenly you have hundreds of millions of consumers on whom you've spent literally nothing in promotional terms. So every time we hear various neoclassical economists or apparatchiks of the Motion Picture Association of America or tame Democratic senators and congresspeople of other stripes saying this is the cost in hundreds of millions of dollars to the United States of movie piracy or TV piracy, it's got to be taken with a grain of salt, in my view, because, yes, of course, there is supposed lost revenue, but think of all the revenue that's going to be set up, that's going to be achievable as a consequence of the free advertising that piracy gives in these emergent markets.
And there's been obviously a battle here over piracy between Silicon Valley here in Northern California and Hollywood here in Southern California. And as you know, Toby Miller, Hollywood hired a somewhat discredited U.S. senator who got a cozy home loan from one of the most egregious of the Wall Street predators, Angelo Mozilla of Countrywide, and through the revolving door, he ended up heading up the Motion Picture Association as their chief lobbyist in Washington. They thought they had a slam dunk because of Chris Dodd's connections to the U.S. Senate. It looked like they were going to get through their anti-piracy act, but then Silicon Valley woke up and trounced them. But that's not to say that Hollywood didn't have a good argument, right?
Absolutely. And just to mention one fact, Chris Dodd is the latest in a long line of people over 70 years who've come directly from public administration in Washington to running the Motion Picture Association of America, people from the postmaster's office, people from president's offices, people from the House of Representatives. In terms of what's going on in this, in a sense, intra-California battle, a struggle between major corporations and entrepreneurs in the north of the state, as you say, the software barons, and in the south of the state, which is to say, if you like, the textual barons or the story barons. It certainly isn't over. Already we've seen a number of major Washington lobbyists basically cut the ties that they've established with software Northern California people, because Hollywood said, enough of that. And Hollywood is much more practiced at basic DC lobbying. What happened, I think, in this case was that they were blindsided by the capacity of immensely popular everyday software like Wikipedia and Google to enlist hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, and certainly hundreds of thousands who are influential in the United States, on their side of the story, which is to say they want everything to be free, except, of course, the stuff that they own, which they want to be able to charge for, whereas Hollywood wants to be able to charge for everything that it can. But one of the things to remember here is that whilst the Northern Californians might say we're the masters of technology, really they're not, because it's Hollywood that has survived successive waves of technological innovation and turned them into money-making opportunities. It did that with the arrival of sound, it did it with the arrival of color, it did it with the televisualization and suburbanization of American life, which cut theatrical attendances. It did it with the emergence of the video cassette recorder and then the DVD, which allowed people to time shift and so on. It's done it with personal video recorders. These all eventually become grist to the mill for Hollywood. And this will be the case undoubtedly with the internet once it's mastered, and it's already en route to doing so, the means of making money from streaming and downloading.
But that's not to say that Hollywood has always been prescient. Hollywood opposed the VCR when it was invented, and it ended up being one of their most successful revenue streams, the blockbuster aftermarket, if you will. They've also Napster. They opposed Napster and these downloads, and of course, arguably, Apple showed the way with iTunes, that you can monetize this new technology if you're smart about it, as opposed to if you sort of use the blunt instrument of lobbying. But my understanding is that, I mean, it is a problem because you've got a whole generation of kids that have grown up on the internet who think everything is for free. And they expect it to be for free. And that clearly, if America's future is, since we've gotten rid of our industrial bases, all we've got left is our intellectual property. Unless we protect our intellectual property, whether it's pharmaceuticals, software, or movies, we don't have a future.
You're absolutely right on both scores, Ian. It's correct to say that Hollywood has been reactive rather than prescient in its relationship to technological innovation over the last 80 years. No argument against that. What it tends to do quite effectively is stem the tide long enough to work out how to turn a buck out of things. That's what it's good at. You know, there's new technology, it could take over. How do we make sure we can monetize it? First point. Second point, you're absolutely correct about the deindustrialization of this country and the fact that the erosion of manufacturing and other sectors has seen intellectual property become from something that used to be boring and of minimal interest to most people, front and center of our economy and front and center of the consciousness of many people. I think the iTunes example you give shows that young people are prepared to pay for their pleasures, actually, online. It's just that it's got to be done in the right way, and the pricing's got to be done in the right way. You know, we're seeing the Los Angeles Times announcing this week a system of trying to monetize use of the internet. The New York Times has managed to do it fairly effectively this time, having ballsed it up the first time around. The Wall Street Journal has done it extremely successfully. So has The Economist in the UK. In fact, The Economist, a weekly newspaper, as it calls itself, it's really like a magazine. Since it made its internet subscription something you have to pay for, its printed sales have gone up. So if you know your market and you work out how you can reach out to people, still retain your intellectual property as a source of revenue, but make bits of it free in order to entice people in and encourage them to pay small amounts of money for reasonably good deals, then I think the monetization can come, especially when, in the case of Hollywood, suddenly you're not so worried about distribution, you're not so worried about transportation, you're not so worried about exhibitors taking a cut, and you're not having to manufacture things like DVDs or VHS cassettes. So there are all kinds of costs that are cut out, and middle people that are cut out, that eventually will see Hollywood doing very well.
Again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who is the chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and the connection to the politics of everyday life. And we're talking about Hollywood versus Silicon Valley. But now that tonight the Academy Awards is Hollywood's opportunity to celebrate its wares to the entire globe, a record global audience is expected this time around. This is a great opportunity for Hollywood to put its best face forward. But the movies are pretty pale. This is, a silent movie. It seems to be, it even won the Indie Award, which is Indie Spirit Awards, which is supposed to be more rebellious, less establishment. So I would suggest that that's probably going to be the establishment choice, the movie The Artist. But most of what they make nowadays are huge blockbusters made for 14-year-old boys, special effects laden, based on comic books. they basically have driven out the low budget movies or even the medium budget movies. They just there's just no room for them anymore.
Well, nowadays, remember that whereas you know the various film industries in India and China churn out at their big studios hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of films a year, the major Hollywood studios, which are basically pretty much the same as they were, you know, well before you and I were born, are producing themselves very few films indeed. They might be producing 15 or 20 on a slate a year compared to what they did, say, 30 or 40 years ago. That's almost nothing. What they do in order to minimize their risk and maximize their return on investment is buy materials, buy texts, buy movies, buy TV shows that are produced at the risk of others. So in other words, they've managed to incorporate the so-called independent edgy film into their distribution arm, and their own resources, they focus, as you say, on these blockbusters that are associated with properties, ideas, contents, fantasies, and so on, that have already been tested in lots of other markets, you know, like a Marvel Comics superhero or a James Bond figure from novels, from cartoons, from newspapers, you name it, or TV series that have already been made. The Hollywood mantras are basically, one, get free money, i.e. money from other people like governments or individuals who won't take equity stakes in the investment, and two, innovate as little as possible. Because by innovating as little as possible, you run the minimal risk. If you stick with generic formats that are well known, you've only got to tweak them 3, 4, 5%, let's say, in order to make the story recognizable to audiences, but subtly different, subtly distinctive. That's the whole deal with, for example, big franchises like Jason Bourne or Iron Man or Star Wars.
So, Toby Miller, if we have a situation where the promotion cost to release films, whether it's a huge cartoon, $100-200 million budget, or whether it's a $10 million highbrow personal movie, the promotional costs are pretty much the same. And my understanding is that the reason that we're not getting the kind of movies that we were used to over the years, and the ones that end up actually winning the Academy Awards because of their content as opposed to their special effects, they're on the way out. Piracy apparently is such that the big movies, they can prevent piracy by releasing them around the world at once, and the little movies that aren't interesting enough to pirate, they leave alone, but the ones in the middle, they go for. So everything seems to be working against, and on top of that, you have to add HBO. They make so many movies that the studios used to make in that mid-range. My fear is that the mid-range movie is becoming extinct.
I think you're absolutely right. And if you talk to people in this town who are screenwriters, lawyers, accountants, producers, and you know them very, very well from much of your own work, it is exactly that mid-budget range film that is being cut out. On the other hand, there's a big problem for overseas films, especially ones that aren't in English, where possibly if, say, they come from a poorer country, they might have made a magnificent movie for the equivalent of $1 million. How are they going to find $50 million to promote it? Quite apart, of course, from the costs of subtitling or dubbing and so on. So there's no doubt that the vast investment in the high concept movie institution is really militating against the medium range film.
Well, Toby Miller, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here in the studio today.
It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who's the chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Global Hollywood, Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, and Television Studies, The Basics. His forthcoming book is Greening the Media. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.